Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 17th of September. And we are so happy to have Brian Green with us this hour of the program. He's the author, and we've interviewed him on these books, The Elegant Universe and the Fabric of the Cosmos. Professor Green is a professor of physics and mathematics at Columbia University, was educated at Harvard University and Oxford, where he was a Rhodes Scholar. He's known for a number of groundbreaking discoveries in superstring theory. He chaired the first annual World Science Festival last May, a gathering of the world's leading scientists. And his latest book is Icarus at the Edge of Time. He'll tell us where the idea of the book came from, which is a great story. But as he was writing it, he thought storytelling is our most basic and powerful means of communication. So why not allow some of the science's greatest wonders to be experienced through the force of narrative, science in fiction, as opposed to science fiction. Thus his book, Icarus at the Edge of Time, which includes full-color images from the Hubble telescope, which are just so dramatic and take you almost into that black hole. He's with us this hour to talk about black holes and to talk about science and superstring theory and all of that. And he's speaking tonight in Milwaukee for those of you who love these kinds of topics, and I know there are many of you. Tonight at 7 o'clock, he'll be at the Harry Schwartz Bookshop on Oakland Avenue. It's in Shorewood. There will be a talk, an AV presentation, and then a question and answer and book signing. So that's tonight. We'll remind you of that later in the show. Brian Green, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
You know, I look at you and I think, how did you get the mind that you have? You know, I'm so envious of it in a way because I wish I could. I get the idea of what you're saying and it's exciting and it then it goes into this realm of, holy cow, this is otherworldly, isn't it?
That's what the wondrous experience of science can be. I mean, science opens up this universe to us. It opens vistas that are fantastically exciting. And I think it's our job as scientists to help more people have the experience that you're referring to feel that they get it, feel that they understand it, feel that it's something that they can really get excited about.
Right. But I don't understand how you get to the point where you can understand what might be going on in a black hole. I mean, how do you learn that information? What do you need at your fingertips to get there?
Well, typically that kind of an understanding comes from mathematics. Hmm. So it's from equations, and many people are put off by equations. But, you know, some of us really revel in equations. And these are equations that Albert Einstein wrote down a long time ago. And if you study them sufficiently intently in the right way, you can learn things about black holes and about the universe on the largest of scales. And then the thing to do is to take that understanding and try to translate it into a language for people who don't want to go to graduate school in mathematics, who don't have the technical training. And I think that is very doable.
Mm-hmm. This particular book, from my understanding, comes from reading stories or telling stories to your son. And then your son started telling you stories as well, which is wonderful because then it led to this.
Yeah, there was one very specific experience. I was telling him some bedtime stories when he was about 2.5. And sometimes I get a little carried away and was talking about ships going near the speed of light. And I wasn't sure if he was getting it or not. But then he turned to me and said, Dad, the speed of light? What about the speed of dark? And it was kind of a wonderful moment for me because it showed how narrative is very powerful, getting the creative juices flowing, even in a youngster, to start to think about these abstract ideas and to reprocess them in a way I'd never heard before, in a new way. And it really shows the power of storytelling to get complex ideas just to wash over you, mm-hmm, and prepare the mind for these things when you study them more formally later on.
Mm-hmm. So you decided to do a book on Icarus, but a different story.
Yes, absolutely. You know, the Icarus myth has always stayed with me since I was a kid. Mm. And it always struck me as a little bit odd the way it ends. You know, the boy has the wax wings. His dad says, don't fly near the sun. But he goes for it anyway. And then he pays the ultimate penalty for that. And as a scientist, I thought that was a kind of strange ending in a way, because we're taught you have to challenge your elders. You have to go against the conventional wisdom. That's how you have great breakthroughs. And you don't pay the penalty of death for that. But there is a different kind of penalty that we as a society have to pay, if you will, which is we have to mature into a newfound understanding. The atomic age in the 40s. We'd learned how to control atoms, and, well, that was something that we had to learn how to deal with, that newfound power. Now we're going through a biological age where we are manipulating genes, manipulating life in the laboratory. We're struggling to come to grips with that newfound power. So we always have to mature into the new land that science takes us to. And the ending of this version, this new version of the Icarus myth, that's really what happens to our young Icarus. Doesn't die, but has to mature into a strange new land that his journey, not to the sun, but near a black hole, takes him to.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the last 100 years having witnessed a panorama of stunning scientific discoveries. Among the most mind-blowing, and indeed they are black holes. And this book is about black holes as well. What exactly are they? What do you know about them? And this whole idea of slowing down time, maybe for thousands of years, is just, you know, I read that and I go, what is this? It's just, it is mind-blowing. I don't know what other word to use.
Yeah. I agree. Black holes are regions of space where a fantastically large amount of mass, as we usually think about it, is crushed to a fantastically small size, resulting in such powerful gravity that if anything gets too close, it can't get away. Even light itself, if it gets too close to a black hole, can't escape, and that's why these objects look black. Light can't get away from them. Now, they were discovered mathematically in 1916, 1917, using Einstein's math. A German physicist found that this was a possibility. Einstein didn't believe it. He saw it in the math, but he said, okay, that's math. It's not actually out there in the universe. But decades later, scientists, astronomers who are studying space now have fantastically convincing evidence that there are these black holes out there in the universe, even in the center of our galaxy, about 26,000 light years from here. There's a huge black hole. It weighs 3 million times as much as the sun.
Wow.
And it's out there. And there's very, very convincing evidence that this is real.
And so where do you get from that to what might happen if you go into that?
Well, we can then go further beyond simply establishing that these objects are actually out there. We can use our understanding of the laws of physics, the laws of gravity, to figure out what would happen if you went near a black hole. If you went near one and, say, we're very careful not to fall over the edge, something we call the event horizon. The name doesn't matter much. But if you stay sufficiently far away from the danger zone of a black hole, there are still some weird things that happen, because black holes warp space and they warp time. Which means if you go near a black hole, your watch ticks off time more slowly than the watch carried by somebody else who's far away from the black hole. Now, this actually is not just true of black holes. If you're on top of a tall building, the Empire State Building, and your friend is down on the street level, your watches will not tick off time at the same rate. Again, the person who's on the ground is experiencing stronger gravity because they're closer to the Earth. And that means their time will tick off more slowly than the person who is on the top of the Empire State Building. Now, it's not much in that kind of situation, billionths of a second, so you hardly would ever notice it. But for a black hole, the effects are magnified. So if you spend some time near a black hole, when you return, a lot more time will have elapsed in the region where you return to. You will, in essence, return to the future.
Wow. And it may be thousands of years.
It can be. It all depends on how big the black hole is and how much time you spend near its edge, how close you get to the edge, all things that we can calculate mathematically. But the idea is plain. Time is not something that's universal. It's not something that's the same for everyone, regardless of where you are. That's the old Newtonian idea. Newton said there's a grand cosmic clock out there that we all are governed by. Second after second after second, we are dragged at exactly the same rate, regardless of what we're doing or where we are, forward in time. That idea, however sensible it sounds, is wrong. If you move relative to somebody else, time for you ticks off at a different rate than for that other individual. If you experience different gravity than somebody else, time ticks off differently for you than for that other person.
Interesting. So Icarus goes to the edge of this. Tell us the story without giving it all away, because it's a dramatic story.
Yeah.
There are a lot of levels to it.
Sure. You know, roughly in this version, rather than flying near the sun, this futuristic Icarus has a spaceship and, against his father's warning, flies near a black hole. Now, he's careful. He's smart. He knows about the danger of black holes, so he doesn't fall in. But he does experience this feature that we are talking about, this warpage of time. So when he returns to a very, very different reality. And it's a painful ending, but it's not the kind of ending that was in the original story. And I think that this ending more closely reflects what science is about. And again, the narrative element, this twisting of time in this fictional story is real. So that's, as you were saying, science in fiction.
Mm-hmm. And what does it say to 14-year-old boys?
Well, you know, I think the myth has stayed with us for as long as it had because it speaks to something that is
right.
so real, right? I think every kid thinks at some point they know better than their elders, and sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. And I think the nuance of this particular version is this Icarus does know a lot,
yeah.
is precocious, does know about general relativity and Einstein and black holes, but he doesn't know everything. And what he doesn't have right in mind at the moment of decision, the critical moment of decision, comes back to haunt him in a very significant way at the
mm-hmm.
end.
Yeah. And the pictures in the book are from the Hubble.
Yes.
They're
yes.
beautiful.
Yes. You know, the designer of the book, Chip Kidd, he and I spoke about the story before figuring out how it would best be illustrated. And we quickly realized that we didn't want something that would be literal.
Right.
You know, a boy
right.
in a ship, you know, that kind of thing where the illustrations just mirror the story. Rather, we wanted something abstract, metaphorical, that captured the sensation that the story was trying to communicate, the atmosphere. And these gorgeous Hubble photographs,
yes,
modified in this very simple graphical way that he did in order to show the approach to a black hole, I think is a very simple but wonderful way of illustrating the ideas.
Mm-hmm. I know your son is still very young, but what does he think of it?
No, he loves the story. I think it will be some time, again, he's only 3 and a half now, before he really can come to grips with the strangeness of the end, you know, this issue of time. Time is such a subtle idea that, you know, we still, even when we're adults, if we think about it, struggle with it. So my view is that this is the kind of book that a youngster like my 3 and a half can just sort of enjoy the story. Later on, perhaps we'll return to it and say, oh, that's why that happened at the end. That's the underlying science. So
yeah.
I think it can be experienced on a number of levels.
And what's this idea that maybe, where do you get this, and is this just way off base, that maybe if you enter these, it could be a path to another universe?
Some people have suggested that. Einstein himself, together with a colleague, Rosen, came up with an idea that maybe, were these things real? Were black holes real? Maybe if you went into one, forget about worrying about danger, actually go into the black hole. Maybe as you approach the center, there is a kind of gateway out to another universe, if you will, on the other side. This is a very speculative idea. It's one that we can understand mathematically, but we really can't see a natural way that such an entity would form in the universe as we know it. So who knows? Maybe there is something like this out there, but there's no evidence at all for it yet.
Yeah. And what is it about you? I know you're a super string guy too, but what is it about your scientific bent that has made you go this direction, become fascinated in it along with super string, when you could do, I don't know, all kinds of other things?
Well, you mean black holes in particular? Well, I mean, black holes, I think, are the most enigmatic and wondrous feature that's come out of modern physics because they push our understanding to the very limit. They are the most extreme form of matter, where matter is crushed to, if you take the math seriously, almost infinite density. And we have learned that we gain our greatest insights when we push our current understanding into the most extreme domains. Black holes are a great extreme domain for us to push our understanding, and people today are working very hard to understand them even better than we do today, and I suspect fantastic insights will come for that. For instance, we still do not know what happens at the very center inside of a black hole. If you were to fall in, what would there actually be in the very middle, if you will? We can follow the math. It tells us something extreme happens, but ultimately the math breaks down right at the center. If you had this on a computer, the computer would have smoke coming out of it metaphorically when it tried to figure out what's happening at the center. So that's a puzzle. And when we understand that puzzle, I think we will have a big leap in our understanding.
How are you going to understand it?
Well, string theory, this theory that you mentioned, is an approach. Many of us believe that you will not be able to understand the center of a black hole until you can put together the two great insights of 20th century physics. Einstein's understanding of gravity, which is what we have been talking about, the general theory of relativity, is one of those great insights. The other is a completely different theory called quantum mechanics, quantum physics, and that describes the small things in the universe, not big things like stars and galaxies, but small things, molecules, atoms, and subatomic particles. The thing is, at the center of a black hole, you need both of those sets of laws at the same time because there's a lot of matter that's crushed at the center of a black hole, but it's also very, very tiny. So you need the laws of the quantum. And for a long time, nobody knew how to put together the laws of general relativity and the laws of quantum physics. That's what string theory purports to do. We don't know if the theory is right. It hasn't been tested yet. But we, nevertheless, are working hard to see what it might tell us about the center of a black hole. There have been some insights. It's still an open issue, but it's a vigorous area of research.
So how do you test it?
That's a good question and a tough one because you don't actually want to jump into a black hole.
Right.
You know, and if you did, even if your theories were confirmed, you wouldn't be able to tell anybody because nothing can get out of a black hole. So one of the possibilities, though, that's very exciting is this new machine that you may have heard about in Geneva, Switzerland, called the Large Hadron Collider.
Right.
This is a 17-mile tunnel underground where protons, little particles of matter, will be sent cycling around in opposite directions near the speed of light, and then they will crash into each other in these head-on collisions, about 500 million collisions every second. And there's a chance, it's a long shot, but there's a chance that we might actually create miniature black holes in those collisions.
Huh.
So if you have these black holes in the laboratory being created, you can study them with a kind of fidelity that is beyond imagination almost, you know, 10 years ago. So whether this will happen or not, I don't know. Some people have become fearful of the idea of creating black holes in the laboratory,
right.
Unfortunately. Sort of the general public has a wrong idea that there'd be some danger.
Right.
There's no danger at all whatsoever. These are little tiny black holes. They would disintegrate in a fraction of a second, long enough for us to study them, but short enough that there's no danger at all. And that may well be where we can get the kind of insight, experimental insight, that we need to go the next step.
Is that the story that was on the news while I was making dinner this week, and they didn't know what – and they did something? They did some kind of experiment? What happened?
Well, what they did is they, for the first time, turned on the machine. This is a machine that's been 20 years in development.
Oh, my gosh.
They're – I don't know, 7 to 10,000 scientists have worked on it. Maybe 60 countries have been involved at one level. So it's one of the largest experiments ever. And they are building up to the collisions in a nice systematic way. They haven't done collisions yet, but last week they, if you will, turned on the switch and sent some protons cycling around to make sure that everything is working properly. So that was an important moment. Everything is working properly, and collisions will start to happen, I think, sometime next month, and then the machine will ramp up to full power in the months that follow.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Brian. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. Brian is the author of The Elegant Universe and the Fabric of the Cosmos. He's a professor of physics and mathematics at Columbia University, educated at Harvard, Oxford, where he was a Rhodes Scholar. He is known for a number of discoveries in superstring theory. He chaired the first annual World Science Festival last May in New York. I want to ask him about that. That must have been fun, gathering of the world's leading scientists. And his latest book is just gorgeous, and it's a terrific story as well, Icarus at the End of Time. He's in town to talk about that and to talk about string theory and black holes and what's happened with scientific discoveries over the last 100 years or so. And he will be tonight. It should be a fascinating speech, and there's going to be an AV presentation. This is at the Schwartz Bookshop on Oakland Avenue tonight in Milwaukee at 7 o'clock. Oh, there go the phone calls. So we'll take them in a moment. And we also have this email thing, which should be working, and that's talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Brian Greene, starting with Pat calling from Chicago. Hi, Pat.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi.
Hi. Good to talk to you. Good work, Dr. Greene. Let me ask you what you've touched on a bit in your intro here, and that's about the center of black holes. And I believe if it shrinks all the way down to a zero diameter, it's called a singularity. Am I using the proper term?
That's right. We often use the word singularity to describe the very center of a black hole. But I should emphasize that singularity is a fancy way that physicists say we don't know what's going on there. That's what the word singularity means to us.
Okay. What I was wondering is, as our state of knowledge of the math and string theory, how confident are we that singularities do or don't exist, that there might be something with more dimensionality because of, you know, quantum uncertainty or whatever? Can you touch and expand on those ideas a little bit?
Yes. Well, you're absolutely in the right direction. Many of us believe that even though Einstein's math has this singularity, which means the math breaks down, it's like if you have a calculator and you put in 1 divided by 0, the calculator yells at you, right? It flashes error message, or there's something on the screen that tells you you did something that is mathematically nonsensical. That's what happens with Einstein's math at the center of a black hole. But many of us believe that if you include the effects of quantum physics, and you've indicated what some of those are, the smearing, the quantum uncertainty, that singularity, that point of infinite density, will get spread out into something that we can understand and something that we can analyze. But what exactly that will be is still very much under discussion.
Now, does your work in string theory apply to this? And if so, what level of confidence are you having that your string theory or one of the string theories is going to be the path to insights, or, you know, some people dispute string theory as the way to go?
Well, I think the best answer I can give there is that, number one, string theory has not given us the answer to what happens at the center of a black hole. But number two, string theory has given us the answer as to how to fix other singularities, not the black hole singularity. But, for instance, work of my own some years ago showed how we can understand the very fabric of space ripping apart. That is something which, in Einstein's mathematics, would create another kind of singularity. The math would break down if space were to tear, like a piece of fabric, like your shirt ripping apart. That would cause the math to break down. But we show that in string theory, the math doesn't break down, and we can understand completely what would happen in that very exotic-sounding situation. That gives us confidence that the work that we're doing may one day allow us to understand the singularity of a black hole, but we have not gotten there yet.
So are you saying that if space comes apart, there's a zero-dimensional thing that's happening in the separation?
There is, in the versions of the space ripping that we studied, and yet we were able to make perfect sense of that. And that's the beauty of this approach, string theory, that puts together gravity and quantum mechanics. It allows you to make sense of things which, without the quantum side, you throw your hands up and say, I just don't understand, the math is breaking down.
Thanks, Pat, for the call. Buck is next from Madison. Hi, Buck.
Hi. I'd like to address the question of black holes as gluttons. They get bigger the more they suck in, and they won't stop sucking it in. Is there a lifespan for black holes? Is there any limit? Are they just like ticks? They get bigger and bigger and bigger?
Yes. So black holes, as you say, when anything falls into them, they respond by getting larger. So if a galaxy falls into a black hole, it gets bigger. If a star falls into a black hole, the black hole gets bigger, and so on. And it would make you think that it's a one-way street. They can only get bigger since nothing can get out. The piece of the story that makes it a little more subtle happened in 1974, as discovered by Stephen Hawking, that when you include some effects of quantum physics, you learn that black holes actually are not completely black. They do allow a little bit of radiation to leak out of their surface. So if you leave a black hole alone, without feeding it, little by little it will emit radiation. It will shrink and shrink and get smaller and smaller. So there is a lifetime to a black hole. It depends on how big it is, because that tells you how much energy it has and therefore how long it can radiate this Hawking radiation. And it turns out that the smaller a black hole is, the quicker it emits that radiation and the more quickly it disappears, which is why the black holes in Geneva, we think, would disappear very, very quickly.
So we've got to be very careful about our orbits, lest we feed this glutton. Right?
The orbits around the black hole in the center of the galaxy, is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, if you fall into it, you just encourage bad behavior.
We are. We definitely are feeding it. There are so many stars and gas that are falling into the black hole in the center of our galaxy, so we are feeding it, and it is getting larger. But that, again, is not something to fear. It's 26,000 light years away.
Now, come on, it's a long-distance problem, you know, further away than extraterrestrial impacts or the Republican Party in our elections. But still, left to its own devices and celestial mechanics, they will get bigger, won't they?
Yes, absolutely.
And then our universe is sucked into some other place, and my house is gone, right?
You know, it could well be. It's hard to speak to that specifically. But the one thing that I would encourage you to bear in mind is that black holes have this reputation as kind of reaching out, and in the language that you use, gobbling stuff up.
Right.
But as long as you stay away from the edge of a black hole, it's no more dangerous than a star, for instance. It has the gravity dependent on its mass, and a star of the same mass would exert the same gravity. So they don't kind of reach out and gobble stuff. It's simply if stuff gets too close, then that stuff can't get away.
But they're predators.
Well, you know, I don't know. You know, they have a very clear demarcation around them. It says, don't get any closer than this. And if you don't get any closer, they leave you alone.
So no diet, and then they die. Clearly, we've got to fund NASA, right?
Well, independent of this conversation, I'd say that we have to fund NASA.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Buck. I like the way you think. You always have interesting calls. Tom is next. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. My question is we know that the universe is expanding, and in relationship to the points of the universe, such as other galaxies, are we able to calculate where this Big Bang occurred and what would be there theoretically right now?
Sure. You know, I think it's a notion that many people have, that if the universe today is expanding, then as you go further back in time, it gets smaller, and we always describe it way back toward the beginning as being very, very small. So the natural question is, well, where was that very small nugget that created the universe? There's a deep misconception in there, though, that's worth addressing, which is when the universe gets smaller, all of space is getting smaller, too. There's no space outside this ever-decreasing mass from which our universe emerges. So the answer to your question, where did the Big Bang take place? Well, it took place right where I'm sitting, right where you're sitting, right where anybody else who's listening is sitting, because all of those distinct locations in space today were the same location way back toward the beginning. Space itself was compressed. So the Big Bang wasn't just like an explosion of matter into pre-existing space. It was the very creation of space through the expansion itself.
Did that leave you dumbfounded, or do you have something else to say, Tom? All right, Tom is gone. We go to Will from Milwaukee. Hi, Will.
Hi, that was amazing. that was a big thought. So I was wondering about Big Bangs and the singularity and black holes, and if it's the same singularity, except maybe the opposite. I was reading A Brief History of Time, and that thought occurred in my head about 2 years ago, and I haven't had anybody to ask since.
Yeah, there is a way in which black holes and the Big Bang, at least at a rough level, seem to be deeply related, and in the language that you use, opposites or reversals of one another, because as we're discussing, the idea of a Big Bang, the universe is crushed to a very small size, a singularity, something that we don't understand, from which everything then comes out, space and time and matter. A black hole sounds like the reverse of that. Matter falls into it to create a black hole. And in fact, the reversal notion goes even further because in a way that's a little hard to describe. When we talk about the center of a black hole, it's not actually even a position in space. It's actually a moment in time. Because it turns out when you cross over the edge of a black hole, the roles of space and time interchange. So one way of thinking about why you are relentlessly dragged to the center of a black hole once you cross over that edge of no return, it's because you are dragged to the center in exactly the same way that we are all dragged to the next moment in time. In the next moment in time, we can try to resist going to the next moment in time, but we can't actually succeed. Similarly, you can try to resist going to the center of a black hole, but by the same exact laws of physics, you won't succeed either. When you finally get to the center of the black hole, that's a place where you can't go any further. That means you can't go any further forward in time. It's the end of time, if you will, at the center of a black hole. So just like the Big Bang is the beginning of time, center of a black hole is the end of time.
Oh, my gosh. Isn't that interesting?
So is it ridiculous to think that possibly on the other side of a black hole there could be a Big Bang happening?
Right. So this, again, is an idea that we touched upon earlier, that maybe there's another universe attached to the center of a black hole in some way. And as I mentioned quickly, ideas to support this have been put forward by many people, including Einstein and others. We have no evidence for it. We really can't imagine any process that would yield this kind of universe on the other side. But who knows? People have speculated upon it.
It's mind-boggling.
Yeah, it is.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks so much for the call. You've said a couple things in the interviews I wanted you to talk a little bit more about. Because some of these relate to the way we live with each other on Earth. It's a necessity, you write, for every adult to look out on the world and see that the wonder of the cosmos transcends everything that divides us. Isn't that true?
Yeah, absolutely. To me, one of the grandest features of science is that it knows no national boundaries. The problems that we as scientists work on here are the same ones that people work on in China and Africa and India and Pakistan. We're all part of this worldwide collective of trying to understand the deep puzzles of the universe. And when people can recognize that these issues are at once exciting, they are inspirational, they're wondrous, and they allow us to work as a global community toward a single goal, trying to unravel black holes or trying to figure out how the universe began, to me, I think that's a very powerful way for us to rise above the strife that afflicts us otherwise.
Yeah. The other thing you talk about is the need to communicate the stories of science, that children need to think of science as the greatest of adventure stories as we've sought to understand ourselves and the universe around us. And I don't think that's happening.
Well, I don't think it's happening either. And really, that was a lot of the motivation behind
for
this book, because, you know, when I talk to kids, so many of them think about science as, oh, that's that subject that I take in school and I have to take the exam and then it's done, or that's the material in that textbook that I had to learn. They don't think of it in terms of the big ideas. And the reason is we so quickly want kids to be able to understand the details of science, solve equations, balance reaction, know parts of a cell and so on. And I think that's all important stuff. So in no way am I soft on hard, detailed science. But at the same time, if you're not inspiring those young minds by showing them things about black holes and the Big Bang and the weirdness of the quantum world, you're depriving them of that which makes science so compelling that they'll want to learn the details. I mean, the analogy, I mean, imagine you're at a music conservatory and all of the students that are taking piano, you only let them practice scales. You never let them listen to great music. You never let them play great music. Will they feel inspired to really rigorously practice those scales? I don't think so. You have to allow the wonder of a subject to be experienced at the same time that you learn the details. So, for instance, in this book, part of the point is to show that science can open up the big ideas without the details.
Right.
You don't need general relativity for this book. You just need to have an interest in a story.
Right.
And in that way, you can take on some of the wondrous ideas of science and be excited, perhaps, to learn the details at some point.
Right. Thanks. Let's go next to Tim from Will. We go to Tim from Birchwood. Hi, Tim.
Hi. I have two quick questions. One is, what determines the size of a black hole? You made reference to small black holes and large black holes and to them losing radiation. And then the other is, if gravity is on a linear type line, which is the basic way I understand it, with black holes being on one end of the spectrum, what would be on the other end of the spectrum? Because you made reference to time slowing down near a black hole. Would time then speed up with the lack of gravity?
Sure. So for the first question, again, you know, many of us intuitively, when we hear the term black hole, think about these, you know, huge things in space. And those are large because they've got large mass. So the size of a black hole, where by size I mean how close can you get to it before you can't get away, is directly determined by the mass of the black hole. So just to give you a sense of scale, if you took the sun and you wanted it to be a black hole, you need to squeeze the entire sun down to 2 miles across. So a black hole with the mass of the sun would be 2 miles across. A black hole with the mass of the Earth would be about a half an inch across. So if you took the Earth and put it in a vise and squeezed the entire Earth down to half an inch, it would be a black hole. Larger black holes are black holes that have larger mass. The black holes in Geneva, Switzerland will be smaller still, smaller than perhaps even the size of a proton. So they'll have little mass and little size. Now, you asked in terms of this scale that you had in mind of black holes being on one end, the most extreme form of gravity, if you will, what's on the other side, and might it be that time speeds up on the other side? No, not at all. It's a natural thought, but the opposite, if you will, of the extreme form of gravity for a black hole is simply empty space, where there's nothing there at all. So there isn't sort of a symmetric size where you slow down on one side and you speed up on another. It's simply you have empty space where time elapses as it does, and then as gravity increases, time slows down ever more. So on one end you have empty space, the other you have this really dense nugget, the black hole.
Hmm. And how would you know if you could get there? How would you know that time was slowing down? How would it affect you?
Well, that's a spectacularly interesting question. You wouldn't. Because not only would your watch slow down, but your thoughts would slow down, your heartbeat would slow down. So from your perspective, it would just be life as always. Someone watching you from far away would see you slowing down and say, whoa, you know, she's like in a slow motion movie.
Huh.
But when you're in a slow motion movie, if you're actually in the movie, whatever rate that the projector runs, it doesn't matter because your thoughts are simply keeping pace with the projection. So everything would slow down. You wouldn't even know it. And that's part of, if you will, the tragedy in this particular story, because the young boy doesn't recognize what's happening to him until it's too late.
But he lives for a long, long time.
He does. So he, in some ways, does something which I think many of us would find exciting.
Right.
Which is he's ultimately able to see the future.
Right.
And, you know, were I given the opportunity to go near a black hole with the possibility of coming back way into the future, it would be very, very tempting. You know, the sadness of it, you know, you can't take the familiar reality with you.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, you are paying a significant price, as does this character, Icarus.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks very much, Tim, for the call. We go to Ken from Oshkosh. Hi, Ken.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
All right.
I just wanted to correct the gentleman. Seeing as how we've had no experience with black holes, we have no idea whether the evaporative Hawking's radiation would take place. And besides that, at CERN, I presume you don't really have a detector for black holes. So you won't even know if you have created those except by a group of equations. By that time, they could have been feeding enough to grow to a size where no matter what you do, this is the hubris of science.
Well, that's a very fair point, and let me just be a little bit more precise in order to quell the worries that you may have initiated by that erudite comment, and that's simply this. So you're right. When we talk about black holes evaporating, it does come from our mathematics. We don't know that it's true. It would be completely shocking were it not to be true, but we've been shocked before, so who knows? Maybe the caller is right. So how then are we confident that there's no danger with the black holes if they were produced at the Large Hadron Collider? Well, another perhaps more convincing argument is this. The collisions at the Large Hadron Collider will be at an energy never before achieved in the laboratory. But the energetic collisions have been achieved and are achieved all the time in the universe around us. There are things called cosmic rays. These are protons that are wafting through space that slam into the Earth, into the Moon, into stars, into the other planets all the time. And they slam into these bodies with an energy far greater than anything that we can muster at the Large Hadron Collider. We have survived those collisions for billions of years, and therefore we will survive the ones which are less powerful, less energetic, less intense at the Large Hadron Collider. Mm.
Brian Greene is our guest this hour, and we'll welcome more phone calls in a moment. His latest book, and it's just, it's beautiful because the pictures are from the Hubble telescope, and it's a terrific story. It takes you, and it's for adults and it's for children, Icarus at the Edge of Time, a new take on Icarus as he goes very close to the edge of a black hole. His father says no. He says, I'm 14, I'm smart, I'm going to do it, and what happens as a result of that? So that's what we're talking about, and superstring, and the future of science, and getting people excited about the emotional side to science and the possibilities and all of that. So Brian is also the author of the bestsellers The Elegant Universe and The Fabric of the Cosmos. He is a professor of physics and mathematics at Columbia University and has been known for a number of groundbreaking discoveries in superstring theory. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Brian Green will be at the Harry W. Schwartz Bookshop, 4093 North Oakland Avenue in Shorewood. So those of you who are listening in the greater Milwaukee area may want to come tonight. It'll be a fascinating evening, a talk, an AV presentation, and a question and answer and book signing. That's tonight at 7 o'clock at Harry Schwartz Bookshop. All right. Let's go to Mary from Milwaukee. Hello, Mary.
Hi, thank you. My question is, what can we expect to find behind that Big Bang? I don't think that has been answered, but maybe it has. I'd like to know. And then one other thing, your guest said that he talked about empty space, and I can't think what that might be.
Great. So the first question has to do with what is behind the Big Bang, or perhaps even phrased temporally, what's perhaps happened before the Big Bang? And it's a very natural question. We talk about the Big Bang as the origin of the universe, but what lit the fuse? What got the universe starting? Was there anything that happened before? And the quick answer is we don't know the answer to that, but there are some possibilities. So one possibility is that time itself came into existence with the Big Bang. So there's even no notion of asking what happened before because there's no notion of time itself. Let me give you an analogy which I think captures that idea because it's a tough one. Imagine you want to go north on the surface of the earth and you walk past someone and you say, which way is north? How do I go further north? They point in the northward direction. You keep on walking. You pass somebody else again. You say, how do I go further north? They point you in the right direction. You finally get to the North Pole and you say to someone standing right there, how do I go further north? And they look at you kind of strange and they say, you can't go further north than the North Pole. This is where north begins. That may be true of time. You can imagine going back in time 10 years, 100 years, a billion years, 10 billion years. But when you get right back to the Big Bang itself, going further back in time may be as meaningless as going further north than the North Pole. That may be where time begins, just like the North Pole is where north begins. Now, having said that, people are definitely studying the possibility that there was a time before the Big Bang. It's very speculative. It's all mathematics at this point. But maybe the Big Bang is one specific interesting moment in the history of the universe, but maybe not the very beginning of it. We don't know yet.
Anything
else? Empty space?
Oh, empty space. So empty space is one of the more subtle ideas that physics has struggled with in the last century, because in Newton's day, you could certainly imagine empty space being the intuitive notion. There's just nothing there. It's just the arena of space with no material object, no energy in there, no electromagnetic radiation, no radio waves, the things that are allowing you to hear me speak right now, and so forth. When quantum physics comes on the scene, it becomes more subtle, because quantum physics requires that everything undergo a little bit of jitter, a little bit of fluctuation. So even in empty space, we've learned the particles come into and out of existence, fields fluctuate up and down. And therefore, the very notion of nothingness is a quite subtle one. When I spoke about empty space before, it was really in that classical setting where you can just think about it as no matter or energy within it. In the quantum setting, I'm talking about an arena where the sum total of all those fluctuations adds up to zero, adds up to no gravitational influence. So it's a little bit more subtle.
Thank you so much, Mary, for your questions. We have so many coming in. Megan from Wisconsin, somewhere on the road. Hi, Megan.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have had what I think is a scientific mind all of my life, but I have been very, very intimidated by the mathematical side of it. Now I have a 12-year-old son who is my, he's my mini-me, I guess. And I see the curiosity and I see the interest. And I guess what I'd really like to do is be able to harness him on the big ideas and the big questions, because I know that that's how I think, and that I know that for him, too, the mathematics is what really, really scares him.
Yes. No, I understand the issue extremely well, and it's the reason I wrote this book, and it's the reason I hope that there'll be other books like this, and it's the reason that I wish it were the case, and it's starting to head in that direction, that our culture would shift in a way where science is stitched into the cultural fabric in a deep way, where you don't need to know the math, you don't need to know the underlying details to still have a lifelong association, a lifelong passion for science. I mean, we did this World Science Festival. You mentioned it before in
New York
last May.
Yes, I wanted to ask you about it.
And it was really for exactly the kind of person that the caller is referring to, the kind of person who wants to be part of science, wants to know what's going on at the cutting edge, but doesn't have the time or inclination to really get into the details. So we had 45 live events for general audiences, everything from neuroscience to nanoscience, cosmology, sustainable development, the science of future cities, and so forth, all produced in a way where the general public can come in with no background, really gain an understanding of what was going on. And we went further. We even had some dance performances inspired by science. Alan Alda wrote a new play based on the letters of Albert Einstein, where you see Einstein through his own words. It was wonderful. We had a showing of The Bourne Identity together with a conversation between neuroscientists and the Hollywood director in order to tease out issues of memory and neuroscience and how they could inform a Hollywood script. So I think if we can finally come to the place as a culture where science is viewed as indispensable to a rich life as art, as music, as literature, as theater, I think this whole notion of how do you engage with science if you feel put out by not knowing the details will evaporate, and that's what I hope will ultimately happen.
So for someone who's looking for resources, if I were to go to Google, what type of thing would I search? And then I have one other question.
Well, one thing I might mention, there's a website for this book called IcarusAtTheEdgeOfTime.com. And there is there a listing of various links where you can follow them to resources on a variety of relevant sciences. So I'd say that's a place to start. I think the NOVA website is a really good place. They have so many programs and so many subjects, and they've done a great job of having websites associated with those programs. So I would suggest those two.
Okay, great. And then real quickly, one other thing that I'm always thinking about is playing within my mind is not the theory of relativity in its classic form by Einstein, but the theory of relativity as it pertains to our human existence and the existence of the universe and other universes that may exist, or other, I shouldn't say other universes that may exist, but I mean there's really an endless possibility for what size really means and how that's relative to what we think of ourselves and what we think of our own universe and what might exist beyond that. And I'll take
okay.
any comments you have off the air.
Thanks, Megan.
Yeah, I mean, the whole notion that perhaps we are a very small part of a much grander cosmos, perhaps even what we think to be the entirety of existence when we look out as far as we can in space, maybe we are like a little atom in a much grander universe, or maybe there are other universes, as the caller indicated, participating in what we call the multiverse. All of these are wonderful ideas that are being pursued, and our latest theories, in fact, suggest that this may be the direction that science takes. Our best theories of cosmology do suggest that the universe is far bigger than anything we can possibly see, even with the most powerful telescope imaginable. And string theory and other approaches are suggesting, and this is highly, highly speculative, but they are suggesting that our universe may be one of many. So this may well be a direction that science will be headed.
How can you be patient enough in your lifetime to not know if you're going to have the answer to that?
I struggle with that question a lot. You know, I've been working on string theory since the mid-80s, and we've yet to have any experimental confirmation of it whatsoever. Could it just be pure math on a page that has nothing to do with the world around us? It could be. But the potential payoff of, for instance, finding the unified theory that Albert Einstein looked for but never found, to me, the payoff is so huge that I'm willing to be patient, willing, as are many of my colleagues around the world, willing to work as hard as we can on this theory and hopefully one day get the experimental confirmation or disproof of the ideas that we're working on.
We have time for maybe one more phone call, and it's this caller. Hi.
Hi,
go right ahead.
I have a 9-year-old son, and he's very interested in Star Wars and that kind of thing, and I think he would be really interested in your book. First of all, I'm wondering how long it is, because he's read quite a few books. He's an avid reader, and I'm wondering, after this book, what you would recommend for something a little more detailed.
Yeah, I mean, this is a short book. This is a book of 34 pages, and it's really a large format book with these rich Hubble images. So it's not a long read, and it really is meant in a way to get the excitement about science really flowing, as opposed to an in-depth study of the ideas that we've been talking about here today. But frankly, you know, I've gotten letters from kids as old as your son, 9, 10 years old, who have read my other books that were geared to a more mature audience, The Elegant Universe and Fabric of the Cosmos. And the level of those questions that I've gotten have been so significant that it convinced me that a real passionate young person can read those books and get a lot out of them, even though the language is perhaps a little sophisticated and the ideas are not particularly easy. So that, I think, is not an impossible jump to take.
Icarus was 14.
Yeah.
Right? Well, this was just fascinating. I just love this. Thank you so much for being with us, and we hope that you'll get a lot of people at your event tonight. You're doing an AV presentation, too?
Yeah, I'll show a lot of visuals about our thinking about black holes.
Great.
And intertwine it with the story.
Okay, thank you, Brian,
thank
so
you,
much
my
for
pleasure.
Being with us. Brian Greene, our guest, the book and is Icarus at the Edge of Time. It has just been published by Knopf, and he's going to be in Milwaukee tonight, Shorewood actually, at the Harry W. Schwartz Bookshop. It's at 4093 North Oakland Avenue. It's in Shorewood. He'll do an AV presentation, a talk, a question and answer, and also a book signing. So those of you who are fascinated by all of this can carry on the conversation. Brian is also the author of The Elegant Universe and the Fabric of the Cosmos. He's a professor of physics and mathematics at Columbia University. He was educated at Harvard and Oxford, where he was a Rhodes Scholar, and is known for a number of groundbreaking discoveries in superstring theory, chaired also the first annual World Science Festival, which sounds like it was a rip-roaring good time. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production as well. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 9 o'clock, right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.